I'm Laura Palmer, host of Island Crime. Season 6, Sweethearts, is the story of three teenage girls who were all murdered in Victoria, Canada, within about 12 months.
So she was scared. Something out there scared her.
You've just created the playground where predators can really thrive.
She was a 16-year-old girl. She was a sweetheart.
Listen to Sweethearts at frequencypodcastnetwork.com or wherever you get podcasts.
Find your frequency.
You're listening to a Frequency Podcast Network production.
For a long time, when a couple was staring down the possible end of their marriage, they would both ask the same thing. Should we stay together for the kids? There's no right way to answer that question. It's unique to the situation. But it's also no longer the only tough question being asked before a divorce. A divorce is expensive. It can be expensive even when it's friendly and well-received by everyone involved. And one big part of that has always been, who gets the house or whose name stays on the lease? Well, in this economy, there might not be a second house or even a second lease, at least not an affordable one. So you can probably guess the other question I mentioned by now. Should we stay together for the home? That's this week on In This Economy. Enjoy.
I've asked my husband for a separation, and we plan to be divorced at the one-year mark.
We got this email from Olivia, a listener based in Vancouver, BC. But you're not hearing her voice or her real name. She's discussing her divorce, after all. So to keep Olivia anonymous, Emily, a friend of this show, is reading it for her.
It's really hard to date and create a new life when you're still living your old life. But it feels impossible to think about living in separate homes.
Olivia and her soon-to-be ex-husband have been together for more than 15 years. They've been married for more than a decade.
We have a house with over $700,000 left on the mortgage, and we don't think selling in this market would be a good idea, since it would be more expensive for us to buy separate places. Even if we did, it's very hard to qualify for a mortgage right now. We know we can get more for our house if we sell at a better time.
While things have been amicable during the process, reconfiguring their living situation just feels impossible.
Renting a second place in our neighborhood would also be expensive. The stuff I've seen is around $2,000 to $4,000 a month, but we need to stay in the area for our daughter's school and activities. We both make six-figure salaries, but we don't see how we can make this work.
So, Olivia wants to know,
what are people doing these days when they want a divorce but feel tied to their home financially?
I'm Jordan Heath Rawlings. You are listening to In This Economy. It's a show where we try to help you understand the systems that create our money problems. And we tackle everything from grocery bills to mortgage rates and credit card debts and getting divorced. Now, in each episode of this show, we hear from a listener, like Olivia, who faces a financial challenge. And then we go to an expert who knows that area of the economy well enough, not just to explain it, but to offer us, if not perfect solutions, then tips, accommodations, ways to try to get at what we're after, even in this economy. Whether you're left or leaving, or you're both throwing in the towel together, separating from someone who you've spent years entwined with, meshing together friends and family and finances, can be emotionally and mentally distressing. That's especially true if kids are involved, and that's before we even talk about money. The cost of a divorce in this country, as you might imagine, can range wildly. If it's all friendly and there's not much to split, the legal fees for an uncontested divorce can be anywhere from a few hundred bucks to $1,000, depending on where you are. But if things get messy and there are larger assets to figure out, and of course, if there are kids involved and there is child support and custody battles, you could be paying anywhere from a few thousand dollars at the low, low end to tens of thousands of dollars or more. And that's especially true if you can't work things out in mediation and the whole thing ends up in court. And keep in mind, those are just the legal fees and the negotiating fees that I'm talking about here, alongside the ever-climbing price of Canadian real estate, of buying and renting two places instead of one, basically anywhere in the country. There are exes like this all across Canada in relationships that are no longer working, but with nowhere to go. But as awkward and sometimes heartbreaking as all that can be, Eva Sachs says that finding and affording alternate living arrangements is only one of the many financial challenges people face once they've decided to call it quits.
Part of the work that I do, as gently as I can, is provide people with a reality check. Can you really have the same lifestyle that you had before divorcing and after divorce? And the sad thing is we really can't. So how do we manage our expectations in terms of lifestyle? And it's especially difficult for the person, for instance, who doesn't want the divorce in the first place.
Eva is the financial expert at The Modern Divorce, which is a Toronto company that offers a streamlined team approach to help couples, hopefully, reach a divorce settlement without going to court. Eva is a certified financial planner, a chartered financial divorce specialist with advanced accreditation, and a certified divorce financial analyst. Eva has heard some things in her time. She deals with the financial issues in separation and divorce, and she's written about the financial burdens and lifestyle shifts that it can bring. Her book is called When Harry Left Sally, Finding Your Way Through Gray Divorce.
So I think we have to separate divorce and the process of divorce from separation agreements. A divorce is an over-the-counter process that really allows people to say that they're no longer married. And so that process, it's paperwork, and it's somewhere between $1,000 and $2,000. And you have to be separated for a year in order to get a divorce. And the expensive part or the cost is working on a separation agreement, which is the contract that details all the nitty-gritty stuff on parenting, kids, dividing property, issues around spousal support, and all of those kinds of things. So there's lots of costs involved in pulling together that separation agreement.
But there must be so many ancillary costs. And I mean, here, when we talk about Olivia, you know, you're looking at getting a new place to live. Or if you're selling the house, you're looking at how you're going to turn that into two different units. You know, it's like what you're losing by splitting your joint finances.
If we're thinking of costs and sort of professional costs and fees, which is what people usually think about,
right,
versus what's this costing me in terms of my life, what's this costing me in my potential lifestyle, that's something I think people don't maybe analyze or think about as much. They think of it in a general sense. The way Olivia is saying is basically, we know we can't afford to sell this house. We know we won't be able to afford buying two homes in our same neighborhood. So how do we deal with those things, and how do we plan for those things? And in today's environment, and certainly in today's housing environment, people are coming to me with exactly those concerns every day.
In the case of a couple where the divorce, let's say, is mutual and there's, you know, not a lot of animosity there, what is the first thing you would tell a couple like that to wrap their heads around as they plan to prepare to separate?
I mean, people tell me all the time when they're calling, oh, we're really amicable. And they start off being amicable.
Right.
And then things change. So they usually say it turns ugly. They don't say we turn ugly. And I think the it turns ugly, it has to do with sort of the social way people look at separation and divorce, the process of divorce. I mean, in general, we think of a divorce as being litigation, adversarial to begin with, as opposed to saying, no, we're starting on neutral territory. So reminding them constantly, if this is what they want to do and they want to stay amicable as best they can. Number one, that they have to continue communicating with each other, not to listen to friends and family, even though they might think they're giving them good advice, because it's the noise from these other people that sometimes moves them in a direction that they didn't think they would end up at. I think really then understanding what they own and what they owe, it's surprising how many people don't have a good handle on that. And also analyzing their cash flow, their current cash flow. What does lifestyle really mean? Hmm. What was our lifestyle costing us? And most people can't answer that question. And most people, when we do start looking at that, are surprised and shocked. I didn't know I spent so much on travel, or I didn't know, gee, I didn't know my Rogers bill was as high as it was. I didn't know we had subscription to X, Y, and Z. And it's usually small little things that surprises people. So getting a handle on that.
Is it that stuff that can turn it ugly, to use a couple's language, when you didn't realize that your spouse was spending X on travel or subscribed to X the number of services or whatever? That could, I imagine, during that process, come as a financial surprise.
Absolutely. I mean, it depends on, you know, couples have different relationships. And one of the first things I ask people is, tell me how you pay your bills. Hmm. Tell me how money comes in. So both of you are working. Yes. Okay. Where do your paychecks go? Well, my paycheck goes into my bank account. His paycheck goes into his bank account. And then what happens? Well, then we put some money into a joint account. And what gets spent out of that account? Well, your mortgage, utilities, you know, taxes, etc. And what happens with the rest of that money? Well, we have some kind of system, and it's over time, if they've been married for any period of time, they somehow have created a system of, they sort of intuitively know what things they are spending on, what things make sense for them and what they think is reasonable. And I think because they're making assumptions there, because they don't know, they're surprised sometimes. And so the person that says, oh yes, my spouse is a spender, and they find out when they really start, when we start analyzing things, that they're really not. And people have different sense of, you know, financial priorities. I mean, there's situations where somebody that's been thinking about separation, divorce has already figured out how things are going to work and have said, yes, I figured it all out and you'll be okay. And has presented almost a budget for their spouse to say, if you only spend this, you'll be fine. And it's a sense of their priorities of what's important.
I want to get into some of the details of how you and other financial divorce specialists navigate that in a minute. But first, because you mentioned it off the top and because it's part of the core of this program, when couples or anybody find themselves a lot closer to the edge financially than they would like, which is happening with increasing frequency now, how does that impact their ability to navigate a divorce? And how do you try to help them navigate that when, you know, let's say you're, you know, making the mortgage, but it's gone up recently and you find you're spending a whole lot more on groceries and you have expenses with the kids and everything else. And then all of a sudden you're looking at trying to divide those things in two. How is that even possible?
Well, good question. How is it possible? So I think that comes back to communications, sitting down, you know, a real reality discussion of saying, okay, where is all of our money going? So how do we now go back to sort of basics of financial planning and saying, no, are we using strictly cash flow to manage life? And then when you put on top of that any kind of now additional expenses that are related to divorce, so whether it's, you know, professional fees or some of these other costs, expenses that we referred to earlier, how do we start dealing with those things? And I think the reality is when people are separating, it can't come from cash flow. People are dipping into savings. People are dipping into their RSPs to manage their lifestyle. How can they not?
Yeah. I think a lot of people feel, well, I know because we talked to them. I think a lot of people feel like they really can't do that, that that's irresponsible financially, even if it's to get you through something like a divorce.
But what's the alternative?
Yeah.
There isn't one, right? It's the same thing as people, you know, I think in the example that you've given from Olivia, they want to stay in their house, they want to keep the house, and they want to stay in the same neighborhood. That, I mean, you know, as financial planners, as people that are working in certainly in mediation or trying working with couples that are going through separation, divorce, we start with goals. We want to stay in the house. We want, you know, the partner to be living in the same neighborhood as well, so it's easier for family, et cetera, et cetera. So we try and see, can we get you there? But we get to the point where, from a pragmatic perspective, there's no way, we've tried everything, there's no way we can get you there. And there's only so much money to go around.
How often do those times where you say no have to do with housing?
Most of the time?
Yeah, I imagine.
For most people, house is the biggest asset. The next biggest asset that people would have is their pension. But pensions are one of those things that are, although they're an asset, they're liquid. They're, you know, they're sitting somewhere in space in a cloud at, you know, OMERS or your company pension plan. So it's not a real asset per se. But yeah, it's a lot. And it's a combination of an asset, and it's also a place to live.
Right.
And it's also a place creating stability for children and for families.
Mm-hmm. So how do you navigate that with them? What do you say? What kind of options do you offer for people like Olivia who say, like, we really, you know, we want to keep this house, we want to keep it in the neighborhood. You look at it and you say, okay, everything on your list here together is probably impossible. What else can you do?
Well, we start to look at that and have people recognize when we're looking at property division, people tend to forget that there's other assets that are involved, and we're looking at that whole asset pool. I refer to it sort of as a pie. So we're slicing that pie in half. And so part of the ingredients in the pie is not just a house. It's other things. It's like a pension. It's like RSPs. It's like other investments. It's like other debts as well. And so there's, in some cases, there may be, if the house is in one half of the pie, and let's say the pension ends up being in the other half of the pie, there could be a balance there. So as much as people just look and say, well, we're just going to be splitting the value of the house and the mortgage, and this is what we're going to be left with, that's not necessarily the case. The other thing certainly we look at, and we're seeing more and more of those kinds of discussions happening, is, yes, in this market environment and interest rate environment, it really doesn't make sense, whether we're splitting up or not, to sell our house. So what do we have to do? And how do we do it in terms of being able to keep the house? That's fine and good, but can both spouses continue living in the house together? Potentially, sometimes, yes.
Huh.
Can they move to another part of the house? Potentially, yes. But those are short-term solutions.
Right.
Somebody may find a way of living elsewhere, but there's a cost to that as well, renting, et cetera, et cetera. So that doesn't help the cause. Now we've got a house and another $2,000 or $3,000 or whatever the case is for monthly rent. And now we've got to furnish the place and so on. So, you know, you start to see how this thing mushrooms and grows. You know, are there short-term alternatives for the other living arrangements? You know, heaven forbid, do they move back if it's a younger couple? Do they move back with a parent?
Hmm.
Do they move back with a family member or a friend for a period of time? You know, we start to look at that as possibilities. But we do want to have those kinds of discussions and not ignore those other expenses if, in fact, that's going to be part and parcel of the picture. And do some of those expenses maybe get reconciled back into the overall settlement at some point in time?
We've sort of beaten around the bush a bit about what you do and how you help couples navigate this world. Maybe just start, because you've written the book on it. What exactly is a gray divorce?
Gray divorce is a label that's used to describe couples that are separating after long-term marriages.
Okay.
And so typically, you know, gray, if long-term marriage, 20, 30 years, likely that they're in their 60s, 70s.
Oh, so it's gray hair.
Well, yes.
Duh.
Grayish.
Makes sense. Sorry. Splitting up at any stage of marriage is probably financially difficult, but you've been married 10, 20 years. I think of myself, I've been married less than 10, and we're already completely like entwined financially. I have no idea. As I listen to you say these things, I have no idea how I would ever do it. Hopefully it will never come to that. But like, it seems so daunting. I can't even imagine after like a quarter century of marriage. How tangled up is everything, and what precisely, maybe you could just walk us through it a bit. What precisely is your role in untangling all that?
If we're talking about gray divorce, so we always refer to this as, you know, people in that situation really have more financial concerns than they do legal concerns. I mean, their big question is, if we do separate, will I be able to retire when I was planning to? What's going to happen to my pension plan? Will we still be able to hold on to the cottage because that's the family gathering place? They're less concerned maybe about their actual matrimonial home. They maybe were thinking of downsizing anyways. So this, you know, is a different discussion of now downsizing is going to is going to be looking a little bit differently. So we focus on those kinds of things more so than we would with a younger couple. And the other thing is when people are divorcing at that stage, there's a lot of things that are more finite. They, you know, we know what retirement is. We know what their assets are. They're not going to be adding a lot more money to their asset base. They pretty much know what their pension payment is going to be if they have a pension plan. So when we start doing forecasting for them, it's much more exact. So we can do much more planning for them than we would for a younger couple where there's so many variables and unknowns and assumptions that we have to make that may not be as accurate.
What advice do you give couples like in that situation or even like in Olivia's where they're facing the reality you just described, where your life is not going to be the same? You are not going to be able to afford separate homes. Like that's got to be fairly devastating for them to hear. What do you tell them to do?
In all of those situations, I think it makes sense for them to work with a divorce team of professionals that can give them a lot of good support. So certainly working with somebody that deals, not a therapist, but deals with the communications and the emotional side of separation and divorce. So they may use better language than I might to help them see the true reality picture. And working with, you know, on the legal side of things, help them see, you know, what the law says, although the law is not as clear as people would like it to be in terms of certainly things like support and options that they may have in terms of dividing property, but also letting them know that as they start to develop and see the future and see what those options are, they can start to say, oh, I can see I can't do this, but what if we did something like this? And, you know, an example, the best example I can give you is I want to keep the house no matter what. No matter what, that's the most important thing to me. And I'll use an example of an older couple. Yes, I'm here and it's a safety place for me and I've got a good support system in the neighborhood. And as they start to look at maybe exploring going up with a real estate agent, maybe looking at other properties, and as they start to explore them, their fear starts to settle down and they start to see they're maybe not as connected to what they wanted originally. So it evolves and it develops over time. And it's amazing to see how that works. And I've seen it over and over and over again.
In terms of housing in particular, what can a couple do about the simple loss of, I'm not just talking about the financial assets here, but the loss of shared buying power? Because it's one thing to be able to sell the home and you each take your cut of the equity and you can use that for whatever else, but you can no longer combine your incomes to qualify for a mortgage. So I imagine that must put most people, like Olivia and her partner, out of the running in this economy for buying a new home. Like, how do you navigate that?
Challenging, of course, but people don't recognize, number one, that it, certainly if they have a family and if they have kids and so if there's some child support being paid and possibly some spousal support being paid as well, that those payments, and depending on the financial institution, I have to couch what I say, but some financial institutions will take that income into account as well for qualifying for a mortgage. So they may say their own income is X, they wouldn't qualify, but now their income is going to be X plus some child support, plus some spousal support. That moves them into a slightly different category, which may allow them to qualify.
Have you ever had couples who start this process, go down this road, take a look at the financial implications and especially the housing implications and say, actually, maybe we'll try therapy?
To be perfectly honest, because I saw that in one of your questions, I've had that happen once.
One time.
One time, and maybe I've been doing this work exclusively for the last 16, 17 years.
Did it stick?
I didn't hear back from them, so I'm assuming that it did. in most instances, it just delays things. Delays things. They'll say, okay, we won't do anything. Certainly, you know, COVID stopped people in their tracks to a degree. And that was interesting. We actually were busier in COVID than ever because you think, oh my gosh, people are stuck at home. And if there's going to be tension in the marriage and the relationship, that certainly didn't help the cause. And in some cases, they said, yeah, we've really got to figure something else and we've got to get through this. People were being creative in terms of trying to create more income out of their homes. Mm-hmm. I mean, the story is always renovating a basement, except people don't think of the cost of renovating a basement and what it takes. And, you know, will they get tenants and so on? In today's world, I think tenants are easy to get because people are looking for housing opportunities. Renting places for, you know, portions of their house for Airbnb has been huge, I'd say, over the last couple of years. Mm-hmm. And people are prepared to do that.
So that situation would be somebody keeps the house, you either renovate or you already have a space that you can use as an Airbnb and whatever. And that income then helps the other person rent or hopefully buy something nearby.
Exactly. So it takes some time to build that up.
Right.
Right. But yeah, people were doing that. Absolutely.
Do you ever talk to people who feel, you know, that they're certain they want out of this marriage, but they are trapped because of housing circumstances in this market?
Yes, and they find it scary. And, you know, how do you deal with that piece? So that's where you need good emotional support, you know, the kinds of partners that we have in, whether it's collaborative or mediation, or the kinds of partners that we have in our modern divorce group. Where they can have, they're more skilled at having those conversations and how to deal with the emotional side of things to be able to say, can you not have the emotion affect you to a degree where you can just say, no, I can't live this way anymore. It's you know, I can't function because of the emotional stress of things. Or can they, you know, say, all right, I can tolerate this for 6 months or a period of time. You know, can we create some kind of interim plans to get people through this sort of interim period? Because it's like limbo land. I really want to be separated, but I'm not separated yet, but we can't do it. And so you're stuck. And it's not we're stuck or we're unstuck. Is there a middle ground that maybe we can work with?
That's what I was going to ask you next, actually. Is there a space in the agreements that you work on to say, we're both going to live in this house for a year, and during that time, all of X money will be going towards creating a down payment for the other partner?
Yeah, absolutely. So a lot of those interim agreements are important. I think even in a final agreement, we see things like we're agreeing to keep the house. One of us is going to be living in that house, but there has to be some formula in the agreement to say how ongoing expenses are going to be paid, right? Because then there'll be some kind of reconciliation. And there's usually something in the agreement and the house will be sold no later than, you know, 3 years, 5 years, no later than the kids finish grade school, something like that. And, but you know, what happens if we've got a major expense in the house? How are we going to pay for that? You know, we pay, right? And again, does it come from cash flow or not at the time? And so you can put all that kind of detail into an agreement or into an interim agreement. So those, again, those are the discussions that we have and get people to really start thinking through. Because again, when you're separating, it's hard to even think about tomorrow. And we're forcing people, except we're guiding them, but we're forcing them to say, okay, not only do you have to think of tomorrow, you got to think of the next 3 years.
Give us a sense, because I imagine people in Olivia's situation and others right now are wondering, to go the extra step with a divorce financial specialist, as opposed to just, you know, already going to a divorce lawyer or a mediator, How much can that typically add to the process in terms of cost? And is it even necessary if you already know how to, you're going to split your assets, or at least I guess you think you do?
Number one, it's not really an additional cost, I'm going to say.
How so?
Mediators, and I'm going to say lawyers to a degree. So the sort of this typical way people would approach that is you go in and see a mediator and you have a discussion. Yes, we're going to work with you. And the starting point for the discussions is financial disclosure. And they give people online forms that they need to fill out. The forms are awful. Most people get very frustrated with them. They don't know how to complete them. They don't know how to get this information on board. And they get flustered and so on. So they'll go back to mediator or lawyer, or mediators or lawyers will say, gee, I'm following up. How come you haven't got it done yet? Blah, 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 blah. And then it gets to the point where they say, all right, now why don't you come in and we'll get somebody in our office to help you.
Right.
All of that takes time and it's an additional expense. If you're working with a lawyer may get their law clerk or somebody in their office to help with that, but they're billing that at their hourly rate. Mm-hmm. And these are people that are not really trained in financial issues.
Right.
So you've got people like myself, those of us that work in this field, that are trained to do that so we can do it much more effectively, efficiently, and provide an educational piece as they're filling this information out. Why are they asking me about this? So this is money that you would have perhaps spent with your lawyer or mediator that you're not spending with them and you're spending with us. So it's not added on, it's
instead of, or in
parcel with. And the challenge for people always in any of these processes is, well, Gina, I've got all these professionals working for me. How do I know and recognize that I'm not doubling up on the services and I'm paying my mediator to do something and now I'm paying Eva to do something? Aren't you guys both doing the same thing? So it's very important that we are very clear on what our roles are. And you're getting somebody who's much more experienced in pulling all of this stuff together.
And I imagine there's a little bit of a therapist that goes along with the territory.
Always. And then, you think about it, especially for the person who maybe hasn't paid attention to family finances.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, there's still people in this world that I don't know how to access my online banking.
Oh, boy.
Okay.
So you're starting from scratch.
So how do we do that? I don't know how we'd get taxes done, but I just sign on the tax form and I don't know where it goes. I wouldn't know how to get. Am I supposed to keep copies of that? Oh, so educating them to say there are now, more online accesses to lots of good information that makes all of that a whole lot easier. So can I show you? Can I help you figure out all these things? How do I get how do I get my house valued?
Right.
So we have, many, many different ways of making that process less painful with less drama. And then it's done, because one of the biggest delays in separation divorce is completion of financial disclosure.
Mm-hmm.
And a lot of these processes, because they're not efficient, you're not paying necessarily for what you think you're getting is, gee, I'm paying for all this legal advice. No, you're getting people paying for somebody following up on stuff that if you were organized, you could do. So I talk to people a lot about, if they can be organized themselves, right? Have all of this ready and get, online passwords, insurance information, finding out if their name is on record on things.
Right.
That's the sort of prep work they can do. And I mean, they should know all of that, whether they're divorcing or not.
But a lot of people don't.
But of course, a lot of people don't. So as, in the time of emotional stress, is it any easier to get that information? No. So we take on that role and try, and again, there's a teaching element, there's an educational element in that, right? This is how you do it, I'll do it for you, but going forward, you can be doing this.
What does it look like when it works for a couple in a situation like Olivia's? So far, this has been, there's going to be a lot of challenges. There's going to be a ton of obstacles. The market is against you. Currently, interest rates are against you. Can you make it work? And surely you must have some examples of couples that are able to separate and financially flourish.
We're used to hearing all the ugly divorce stories, right? The extreme divorce stories, right? Those are rare. Most separations go fairly smoothly, or the end result ends up being fairly smooth. There isn't lots of drama. you know, the stats tell us that less than 5% of divorce cases actually end up in court. Court proceedings may start, but less than 5% actually go to trial. Right? There's a lot of, you know, discussions back and forth and lawyer negotiations and so on, but you know, the whole excitement in sort of court and people asking all sorts of questions and stuff. So that's rare. And you know, the average family, I'm going to say Olivia is probably as average as we see. We ultimately see good results. In terms of trying to think of an example, we had a situation where family wanted to keep the house for the sake of the kids. Dad wanted to buy a house. The equalization was such that the wife, based on other assets and so on, the wife would owe her husband a certain amount of money. She didn't have the cash to pay him all of that. He didn't want to rent something and then buy something. So the whole notion of moving twice didn't appeal to him. So we made the suggestion and we looked at the option of her going to her financial institution and asking what was the maximum amount of mortgage she could get based on her income, including a bit of child support that he was going to pay her. She owed him in total, I'm going to make up numbers here, but let's say $150,000. She could only qualify for an additional $75,000. He was prepared to take that $75,000 now because that was enough for him to make a down payment on a condo that he was buying. And they had put wording in the agreement that she would pay him the balance that she owed him and some calculations with some interest and so on. Again, in that 3 or 5 year period when the house was being sold. Worked for her, worked for him. So there's a lot of creative solutions that we can try and figure out for people.
Eva, thank you so much for this. This is really helpful.
You're welcome.
Now, if you're about to embark on this adventure, or if you just want to make sure that you're prepared for the thing none of us ever think will happen, here's what you can do. First, Eva says the biggest delay in divorce is pulling together financial disclosure. So get your money right. Spend some time pulling together any relevant loan agreements, payment plans, contracts, invoices, insurance policy, even your passwords for things like MyCRA and any shared banking accounts. Having all of this in one place will not only give you peace of mind, it will also save you time and money if you do go down this road. If you're having trouble figuring out where everything is, or even what's considered an asset beyond like a house or a pension, you might want to consider reaching out to your accountant if you have one, or maybe you do need a divorce financial expert like Eva. Second, get real about how much your current lifestyle costs you and what you'll be able to afford when it's your income alone. Do you know where your money is currently going? How do you want to use that money during this separation process? And what about after? If you don't have a great sense right now of how you spend, take some time to look over your bank statements, track your purchases for a week to figure out where your money goes, and then set some goals. You won't be able to pick everything, so what is really important for you to have in the new life you plan to build? For Olivia, that's clearly staying in her neighborhood. For you, that could be enough savings to feel secure, or a car to take off and start a new adventure. But whatever you want your life to look like after this big transition, work with a financial expert to determine how you may be able to afford to make it a reality. Lastly, I know that none of us, myself included, want to think about the possibility the person we built a life with may not be in it forever. But having an uncomfortable conversation where you consider that reality together and talk about how you would want to treat and support each other if you ever did decide to separate could save both of you some emotional and financial heartbreak. This is all really uncomfortable to talk about, but it's better to have these conversations calmly now than angry later. Thanks to Eva for some advice that will hopefully help you out if you're going through this. And remember, her book is called When Harry Left Sally, Finding Your Way Through Gray Divorce. Thank you so much to Olivia for writing in and sharing the challenges that you're experiencing during this transition. Can't be easy, but I bet there's someone else listening that you've helped. If you would like to share your money problems like Olivia did, we want to hear from you. You can email us anytime. That address is hello@itepod.ca. If you'd rather talk it out, you can call us at 416-935-5935 and leave us a voicemail. Remember, though, if you'd like us to get in touch with you, we might not need your real name. We need your real phone number or your real email address. And if you want more of In This Economy, we want to keep making it for you, and we need your support. You don't have to pay us a dime, but you do have to find this show in your favorite podcast player and rate it or review it if it lets you. And if you've got a friend that has a money problem, as everybody does right now, send this show to them. Tell them maybe it can help. If we don't have an episode about something they're struggling with, tell them to call us or email us, and we'll do our best to help them out. If you're a social media person, we are on Instagram and TikTok at In This Economy Pod. I am your host and executive producer, Jordan Heath Rawlings. This episode was written and produced by Ali Graham. Our showrunner is Stephanie Phillips. Our sound design was done by Ryan Clark, Mary Jubrin. It's our digital editor, Diana Kay, is our manager of business development. Together, that makes us the Frequency Podcast Network, and we're a division of Rogers. Thanks once again for listening. We'll see you next week on In This Economy.
In 2007, TV network CBS dropped 40 kids in the middle of the New Mexico desert as part of a brand new reality show. These kids would have to build their own society from scratch. And if this sounds like Lord of the Flies to you, well, it was meant to.
We were on this mission together, and we were going to prove to the world that we could make a better society than adults could.
I'm Josh Gwynn, and I want to know what this wild TV experiment was really about. Split Screen, Kid Nation, a 6-part podcast from CBC. Available now.